Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, The Storm, an antebellum tale of Key West, is a novella written by Ellen Brown Anderson in the mid-1800s, but published for the first time by editor Keith Honeycutt.
The Storm is told by a first-person retrospective narrator. Her name is Jenny Mansfield.
We'll discuss the National Youth Administration in Florida.
The NYA was a decentralized organization that allowed state and local officials to guide activities. The program emphasized job training, relief, education, and patriotism.
And a new historic marker recognizes the work of Desi Arnaz in Miami Beach. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
After the storm.
The Storm, an antebellum tale of Key West by Ellen Brown Anderson, believed to be the first novella written by a woman in Florida, is being published for the first time by the University Press of Florida. The book is edited by Keith Honeycutt, professor of English at Florida Southern College. The unsigned manuscript of The Storm was donated to the University of Florida in 2015. Knowing that Honeycutt had edited the book Echoes from a Distant Frontier, the Brown Sisters' Correspondence from Antebellum Florida, 1835 to 1850, with James M. Denham, UF's Jim Cusick sent a copy of the unpublished manuscript to Honeycutt, since it might have been written by Ellen Brown Anderson.
I looked at the manuscript, and I was convinced immediately that it was Ellen's. And so I went up to UF and Jim showed it to me and, let me read it and take digital photos so that I could study it a little bit better. And then he showed me, on top of that, the donor card. It was donated by Gary Nipps in 2015. So I had a clue, and then a bigger clue. He gave me a copy of an unpublished and sort of partially finished introduction to The Storm that someone else had done. And it was a lawyer, an Alachua County lawyer named Norm LeCoe. And of course, I immediately knew the name because Norm LeCoe was also involved with the letters of the Brown Sisters when they first appeared in Florida. So I knew that anything he said would have some validity to it. He wasn't just entirely guessing. And so Norm's unpublished essay guessed that it might be the Brown Sisters.
Keith Honeycutt believed he had enough evidence to conclude that Ellen Brown Anderson had written The Storm, but he thought it was important to track down Norm LeCoe to get his perspective on the unpublished novel.
He had moved out of Alachua County and down to Naples and was retired and was a little bit hard to find. But old reliable Mike Denham said he would go with me. And so we headed down to Naples and found Norm and talked to him. And he turned over to me a box full of letters and manuscripts, all sorts of copies of stuff, and told me that I could borrow it for a while. And So I started sifting through those letters for evidence about the storm and its origins. And then, and this was back in Lakeland, where I live and where I work. And then Norm and I started a very fruitful correspondence about how he got his hands on not only those letters, but the manuscript of the storm. So he had seen both of them, both the manuscript for the storm and all of those hundreds of letters before Mike or I ever saw them. So I mean, his perspective was a little different from ours, and he's a full-time lawyer and couldn't devote as much time to him to them as we could, but still he had some pretty good hunches and some good evidence. And so I just started putting all that together, and before long I was convinced that it was the Brown sisters, and mostly Ellen. Maybe Corinna had a hand in it, but it was mostly Ellen.
In 1835, Ellen and Corinna moved from Portsmouth, New Hampshire to St. Augustine and then to Mandarin, Florida. Eventually, they made their way to Key West. Keith Honeycutt.
Their aunt Delia had set up a hat shop in St. Augustine, and apparently she was a pretty brave soul, and she, urged them to move down and said, "Life's great in Florida, come on down." And so one of their older sisters, Adelaide, came down in 1833 and immediately died from fever. But that didn't discourage them. They came down in 1835, and by then Delia had married Dr. James Hall of Mandarin, a rich planter, and he said, "Y'all come on and live with us." And so the sisters moved to a smaller house on the plantation in Mandarin, and from there they moved all around St. Augustine, Jacksonville, and eventually, as you mentioned, Corinna married Edward Aldrich in maybe 1837 or 8, and then in 1840 Ellen married Captain James Anderson, who was stationed in Florida, as you might guess, as part of the Second Seminole War to fight the Seminoles. And Dr. Aldrich was a surgeon who followed the army. So they moved all over Florida, including Noonansville, Mineral Springs, Pensacola, Picolata, I believe, just all over the place. By 1847, James was with his unit of the army, and they were in Mexico, and he was killed. Churubusco, I believe, is where they were, just outside Mexico City. And so the rest of them were in Pensacola at the time. And so Edward wanted to apply for the job as a Marine surgeon in Key West.
Ellen Brown Anderson was a widow with three children who followed her sister Corinna and her husband to Key West. The family was not in Key West for the Havana hurricane of 1846, but their letters indicate that they discussed the storm thoroughly with residents who were there. Ellen's novella, The Storm, centers around the life of a 16-year-old girl.
The storm is told by a first-person retrospective narrator. Her name is Jenny Mansfield, but she's an older adult, and she's remembering her year in Key West when she was 16, and her name was Jenny Greenough because she had just gotten married. She was. And we're talking about the character now, not Ellen Anderson anymore. I get the two mixed up sometime, but they're completely distinct. It's Ellen's character that I'm talking about now. So Jenny is from New York, and this physician, Peter Greenough, he's 29, he's a little older, marries her. Her family approves, and he takes her to Key West to get rich, as people did in 1840, late 1840s, because I guess it's a boom town back then. So that was the reason that the character is there. And She describes it as a beautiful place, of course, and she lives in a beautiful house, and the manuscript has drawings. It has one drawing that shows the view from her front porch, and that's the cover photo for the book, The Storm. Okay, so she loves her life there at first until she starts to feel a little bit of disillusionment with being married at that age and a little discontent because her husband dismisses her. Her concerns and her worries and her interests. She tries to make other friends, but he clamps down on her and won't let her socialize much. So the story becomes pretty complex with her struggles with this life. She does get out some in the daytime, and he disappears, supposedly doing his doctoring work. She meets some people. She goes to the lighthouse and talks to the lighthouse keeper and his family, and they talk about things like women's education, which I guess everybody was doing back then. And she's again unhappy that she doesn't have a profession that she can fall back on. So that there's a lot about her that makes Jenny an interesting character for a 16-year-old, but she's not happy entirely with life as it is.
In the book, the storm destroys Jenny's house and kills her husband and sister, who Jenny discovers were planning to elope to England. Without giving too much away, Jenny does have a happy ending and a fulfilling life. Ellen Brown Anderson did not achieve her dream of becoming a successful writer, but her book The Storm, An Antebellum Tale of Key West, is now published by the University Press of Florida. Keith Honeycutt will discuss the book at the upcoming Florida Historical Society Annual Meeting and Symposium at the University of Central Florida, October 18th and 19th. And flowers in your hair. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. In 1933, Congress and newly inaugurated President Franklin D. Roosevelt met the crisis of the Great Depression with a multifaceted program called the New Deal. It tackled unemployment, hunger, and stimulated the economy through the creation of a series of government agencies. Most became known by their acronyms, WPA, CCC, TVA, AAA, and others. Historians call them the alphabet agencies. Connie, is a mostly rural state with a small population, Florida is not always considered in national studies of the New Deal.
No, it's not. Dave Nelson, a historian well known to many of our listeners, studies the 1930s in Florida and provided the Florida Historical Quarterly with a 2007 article on the National Youth Administration, one of the lesser studied agencies, but one that enables a glimpse into New Deal thinking and planning in regard to women's roles in the economy. Nelson opens his article with an analysis of a 1940 Life magazine article on government and youth that presented the Civilian Conservation Corps as boys' work relief and featured Camp Roosevelt, an NYA resident facility for girls located in Ocala, Florida. In Nelson's words, quote, "An analysis of Camp Roosevelt, featured so prominently in Life magazine, fills a gap in the historical literature by focusing on the interaction between Florida officials charged with implementing the relief and federal directors, and raises new questions about the gendered nature of the New Deal efforts. Paradoxically," he claims, The gendered nature of the National Youth Administration marginalized the program and allowed supervisors more freedom to meet its goals and produce positive results than was the case for the popular programs such as the CCC and WPA. As a result, the NYA achieved tangible and productive benefits for some of Florida's poorest young women, end quote.
So out of sight, out of mind worked in favor of the NYA.
Nelson argues that it did. As he explains, quote, New Deal reformers recognized that the lack of jobs and declining hopes for the future fueled dissent and aided the rise of communism and fascism, end quote, which seemed evident in European nations also struggling with the global depression. One-third of the nation's unemployed fell within the age group defined as youth, that is, those between 16 and 25 years of age. Every year, some 2.5 million youth dropped out of school in search of work. From all segments of the economy, leaders raised concerns about the growing number of youth without education or jobs. In 1933, Roosevelt proposed the Civilian Conservation Corps for young men. Dedicated to restoring the nation's forest, the Corps was seen by the President as an alternative to traditional schools, a program of conservation projects by day and classes in the evening. In 1935, Roosevelt created the National Youth Administration through Executive Order No. 7086 and placed the program under the Works Projects Administration to avoid the need for congressional approval. The NYA was a decentralized organization that allowed state and local officials to guide activities. The program emphasized job training, relief, education, and patriotism. It sponsored two programs, high school college student aid and work relief projects with job training. The goal was to keep students in school by providing stipends that were earned through after-school jobs, such as working in government agencies or libraries. For those who had already left school, participants lived in resident camps and constructed public parks and community centers, restocked fish hatcheries, worked in government offices and libraries, assisted nursing staff in hospitals, and provided farm labor.
And Connie, Mary McLeod Bethune was associated with the NYA, right?
Yes, she was. She served as National Director of Negro Affairs in the NYA. Her position points to one of the more interesting aspects of the organization. The NYA was perceived by the public as focused on white girls, but it also provided training and relief for white boys and black youth. There were 5 resident camps in Florida. 2 were for African Americans, Camp Bethune in Daytona for black girls, and Camp Franklin, a co-ed facility on the FAMU campus. 2 camps housed white males, Camp DeSoto in Tampa and Cherry Lake Residence Center. White female youths were housed at Camp Roosevelt in Ocala. The girls arrived in May 1939, but the Ocala facility had been constructed earlier to house workers on the abandoned Cross Florida Barge Canal project. Bethune visited Camp Roosevelt and described it as splendid, although noting the contrast with facilities for black youth. Girls were encouraged to organize a student government and publish a camp newspaper, which they called the Roosevelt Roundup. They attended classes Monday through Friday and chose between several tracks, commercial, catering, homemaking, and beautician training. The commercial track was a year-long course in which enrollees could earn a certificate in one of 3 areas, secretarial, stenographic, or bookkeeping. The beautician school was 50 weeks and enabled a graduate to obtain a beautician's license. In addition to their coursework, participants worked in sewing rooms to produce clothing for charitable organizations. For their work, they earned $24 a month, with deductions made for food and medical and laundry services. As Nelson notes, quote, the goal at Camp Roosevelt was to find employment for women in the local job market, not to challenge prevailing gender roles, end quote. And yet, the experience brought many of them into the job market, who would never have entered it without NYA training. As war broke out in Europe and the potential for American involvement increased, training shifted in all camps to channel youth into defense work, Nelson notes that, quote, the shift to defense, especially by late 1941, resulted in the masculinization of NYA's public image, end quote. Boys were enrolled at Camp Roosevelt, and new courses were added in auto mechanics, wood shop, and aviation repair. In 1942, girls were receiving training in repair of radios and small motors, although camp leaders worried that, quote, failure to select girls who can be successful at shop work makes the whole plan of using girls in this capacity vulnerable to criticism, end quote. By 1943, funding for the NYA ended as Congress saw the program as costly and top-heavy, an unnecessary expense in the larger war effort. Nelson concludes that, quote, overall, the program ran for too short a time and affected too few women to make a significant impact on the economic and political lives of female Floridians. And yet, the program introduced hundreds of women to the urban job market and provided them with skills they would never have obtained otherwise. It offered a chance for economic independence, end quote.
Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. An historic marker recognizing the work of Desi Arnaz is being unveiled in Miami Beach. Holly Baker has more.
Before he brought Ricky Ricardo to life on the popular television show I Love Lucy, Cuban-born Desi Arnaz was a musician known as Miami's Conga King. In 1937, he ignited the conga dance craze in Miami Beach at the Park Avenue restaurant on Collins Avenue and 23rd Street. Writer, lecturer, and Florida native Gary McKechnie told me about his campaign to place a historical marker for Desi Arnaz in Miami Beach.
It's interesting, Holly. This started in the spring of 2022. I first had to approach the Florida Historic Marker Commission and basically petition them and prove my case that Desi Arnaz was worthy of a Florida Historic Marker. And I was really thrilled when that passed unanimously.
Desi Arnaz arrived in Miami from Cuba in 1934. To make ends meet, he helped his father lay tile in Miami Beach homes. He worked at Woolworth's and even had a job cleaning canary cages for 25 cents a cage. After finishing high school, Desi Arnaz, a musician at heart, found a way to make money through his love of music. In 1937, he performed the song Babaloo during an audition to be a singing guitarist at the Roney Plaza Hotel.
Pensando lo velorio y qué le hacemos a Babalú. Dame 17 velas pa ponerlo en cruz. Y dame un cabo de tabaco mañequeñe y un jarrito de aguardiente. Y dame un poco de dinero mañequeñe pa' que me dé la suerte. Yep. A gozar, nena. En Santiago se baila la conga. Yo quiero pedir que mi negara me quiera.
Latin band leader Xavier Cugat heard Desi Arnaz's audition, hired him as a vocalist, and brought him on tour. Arnaz eventually left Cugat's orchestra and struck out on his own. He performed at several Miami Beach clubs and hotels, such as the Roney Plaza, the Clay Hotel, and other venues. The Park Avenue restaurant on Collins Avenue and 23rd Street, where the Miami City Ballet currently stands, was where he started the conga craze in America. While performing there one infamous night, December 30, 1937, 20-year-old Desi Arnaz strapped on his conga drum and taught the orchestra the conga rhythm. In what Arnaz remembered as My Dance of Desperation in his 1976 autobiography, the band started playing the conga beat while Arnaz instructed the audience to gather behind him as he created a conga line that snaked around the dance floor and continued outside into the streets. The publicity that followed the performance raised his profile and led him first to Broadway and then to Hollywood, where he met the love of his life and future wife, Lucille Ball. That's why Miami Beach is the ideal location for a historical marker dedicated to Desi Arnaz. Gary McKechnie.
Desi came to America as a teenage refugee in 1934. 20 years later, exactly 20 years later, 1954, that's when he's being recognized, he and Lucy, on Toast of the Town by Ed Sullivan. And I think in the last 20 years, what have I done? He came to America not knowing English, without a penny in his pocket. He's cleaning bird cages. He's living in a rat-infested warehouse. And to go from that in 1934 to learning English, starting a band, launching the conga craze, being on Broadway, being in Hollywood, forming an orchestra, marrying Lucy, creating I Love Lucy, Desi Lu Productions, buying RKO Studios. How does anyone do that in 20 years? So to me, he's a phenomenon and someone who's certainly worthy of this tribute. So what in whatever small role I'm playing in sharing his story, I'm really happy to be a part of that. And I hope people look at him and, again, recognize America as this land of opportunity. It was for him in 1934, and in 2024, 90 years later, it's still that. That's why people are still coming here from around the world, creating this melting pot, creating this very diverse culture, and getting an opportunity to succeed.
After 3 years of raising money and working with the city of Miami Beach, Gary McKechnie's campaign to place a historical marker for Desi Arnaz is coming to fruition. On October 15, 2024, the final day of National Hispanic Heritage Month and the anniversary of the first airing of I Love Lucy, the city of Miami Beach will place a marker in Collins Park in honor of Arnaz's historic performance at the Park Avenue restaurant that launched his career in 1937, as well as a nationwide conga craze.
Somebody said, you know, Gary, you know what you just did? I said, what? And they said, you're introducing these people to a hero they didn't know they had. And I thought, wow, you know, that is wonderful. Everybody, they know of him, but they don't know his story in Miami. And when they learn of his story, I think you can't help admire the guy. And you can't help looking at him and saying, if I were in a situation like that, what would I do? And he's already shown you what is possible. This marker is more than just a piece of metal. It's talking about possibilities. It's talking about opportunities. It's talking about what it's like to be an American, how everyone can contribute and everyone should try. So it will be there, I would imagine, long after all of us are gone, but it should continue to inspire people for generations.
The historical marker for Desi Arnaz is a heartfelt tribute to Miami's Conga King and one of America's most beloved television stars. The dedication ceremony will be held in Collins Park on October 15th, beginning at 4 p.m. It's free and open to the public. For more information, go to miamibeachfl.gov. For Florida Frontiers, I'm historian Holly Baker.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and this week, Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.